it was brutal because I was sort of, I was 21 years old and I was thinking, I need to be fighting here. I need to get going. And I had a doctor phone me and said, sorry, you're never going to box again. So when someone like a doctor rings you and tells you something like that, you're thinking, oh, this might be over. I can remember becoming world champion and it was great. In that ring, there was like a moment where I was like, oh, I've done it. And then there was so much going on. And I remember getting back home or back to the hotel room with Laura. And I sat down on the edge of the bed and I sat and I said to her, this isn't what I wanted. It was my life. I didn't have another life. I was Ryan Burnett, the boxer. I didn't know what it was like to go for a week without training. I didn't know. My whole life was different.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He's one of them bullying back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello, thank you for joining me this week. I'm joined by Ireland's former two-belt world champion, Ryan Burnett. I first met Ryan back in, I think it was 2012, just after he turned pro when he was working with Ricky Hatton. And I've interviewed him at numerous points through his career. This is by far the most content I've heard him, even though his time in the ring was cut short through injury. He was a decorated former amateur, and as a professional, he won 20 and lost just one of his pro fights. And the loss was when the injury happened in the World Boxing Super Series against the brilliant Filipino Nonito Donaire, who, if you're a fan of Donaire, you can listen to him in our archives. There was one more attempt for Ryan to make things work, but there would actually be no way back. Before we get going, you can get episodes in advance up on Patreon. There's future episodes with Curtis Woodhouse and Philadelphia veteran fight scribe Bernard Fernandez. And I'm hopefully talking to Kelly Pavlik this week. It's been a busy week on Patreon as well. We had a Zoom gathering, which was great, where it was sort of a question and answer format, but it was more just general boxing conversation. It was really, really good. Really enjoyed it. And it was great to see everyone. And yeah, so there's loads going on over on my Patreon page. And also people over there can get my new book, Damage, at a reduced cost of £22, signed and delivered. I will be putting them out on general sale for £27, signed and delivered from there on in. This podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And now here's the brilliant Ryan Burnett. So how's life treating you now?
Good. It's now boxing, sort of. It's over and done with. I got my gym up and going. I've got married. So things are good.
And you say that. I mean, I saw the show you've recorded in, I think it was BBC Northern Ireland, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it pointed and alluded to the fact that obviously not just boxers, but sports stars struggle in retirement and stuff. How tough was that first bit?
At the beginning, because boxing's all I've ever known my entire life since I was eight years old, I got lost big time. You sort of fall in a dark hole for a while. But after a bit of bumpy road up and down and stuff, sort of leveled out, and I said to myself, I need to get a grip of things here before I don't want to end up like other sports people who retire and go down the wrong path and stuff like that. I was really determined not to become that. So sort of after going down a bit, I knuckled down and said, right, it's time to get a hold of everything.
Okay, I want to revisit that bit a little bit later on, but you retired after a number of injuries. How's the body now?
It's, do you know what? It's still not 100%. I still get pains on my side, and when I do anything really strenuous, I still get pains, and sometimes I wake up and in the morning times and I'm in a bad way, but it's dealable. I can deal with it now, so I don't really dwell on it as such.
But it's not one of those things there where you wake up and you think, oh, I could start all over again. It's still like in play. It would still hinder you from coming back and all the rest of it.
Well, sometimes I'm thinking I feel great here, so I do. And I'll have a tear on the bag or something like that, and then I instantly know that there's no chance.
Was it mission accomplished for you by the end of your career with what you'd achieved?
Definitely.
And why do you say that? Because you were a double champ. I mean, because obviously you achieved a lot, but there was obviously just 21 pro fights. You know, when you set out, what was the dream? Was it to be world champion and that was it?
Well, to be honest, the dream right at the beginning, obviously, every boxer's dream, I want to be world champion. And that's something I pushed for. That was the goal. But the night I became world champion was the night I realized that wasn't the goal. Like, becoming world champion wasn't what I truly wanted. And then my goal changed. So,
what did the goal become?
I always just wanted to own my own home. So, and then my goal after winning, becoming world champion was, right, that the shiny belt isn't going to feed me forever. So it's time to, everything sort of changed after that.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you say about, you know, everyone has that dream of being a world champion. People then think that all your bills are paid for the rest of your life.
That's really not the case. I boxed for a world title and it really wasn't for much. I became world champion and not much came with it.
Did the World Boxing Super Series money, did that allow you to retire?
No, it didn't allow me to retire. I mean, it definitely set me up in life and it put me on it gave me a great running start with everything that I've got at the moment, but not necessarily retire for where I could sail off in the sunset.
It's nice, you know, when you say obviously that what you wanted to do was have your own house and have your own bricks and mortar, it gives me an added appreciation of any of your Instagram posts when you're at home and you're clearly satisfied with your lot, which is great because so many people don't have that contentment.
Yeah, I sort of, after becoming world champion, that was the goal, own my own home. And when I achieved that, I expected that feeling to be the feeling I had when I won my world title. When I knew that I own my dream home, it was like, oh, geez, that was the feeling that I was searching for.
Wow, that's amazing. So that's great. It's great. And it's great for it to click like that, for you to think, oh, that's what it was all about.
Yeah, definitely.
What was it like? Rewinding, Ryan, what was it like growing up in Belfast back in the day in the 90s?
Belfast was mad. So it was, there was a lot of trouble and everything growing up. But because I was just born into it, I didn't know any difference. So it was just normal to me, I suppose.
Well, that was one of my questions. Was there lasting damage through the communities from the Troubles, even into the 90s?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Where I lived, my mum and dad lived in a park, the gate lodge of a park, and right through the middle of the park was a massive peace fence, maybe 20 foot high, and it would separate both sides of the community. So, and there was always trouble there. My whole life growing up, like, there was always trouble there. But I just thought, it's just normal because that's what I was born into. So it didn't affect me or anything like that.
Were you involved in any of it?
Yeah, plenty.
Were you actually?
Yeah, I was. I was young and I was stupid and I was sort of gang mentality. As a young kid, you sort of just go along with what your friends are doing. But then when I was old enough to sort of think for myself, then obviously that was just a thing of the past.
Did boxing play a role in allowing you to put that stuff behind you?
Yeah, definitely. In boxing, it kept me off the streets, and it was always, that was from 9 years old, 9 years old, that was the place where I was always going to, and that boxing sort of separated me away from getting in trouble and going out with my friends and stuff like that.
Did you play other sports?
No. If I kicked the football, it went that way. So I was only good with these. That was it.
And did you actually get into trouble, like, rather than not just doing trouble? Did you get into trouble? Like, did you get arrested or anything like that?
Yeah, I've been arrested for fighting and causing trouble. And I always had an attitude of let my hands go. So when I was in school, I was always suspended and stuff like that. I think they call it little man syndrome. I've definitely got it.
How did you get into boxing? What was the first trip to the gym? How did that look?
My friend was going to the gym, and he says to me, oh, I have to leave. No, I'm going to the gym. And I went, well, can I go? And he said, yeah. So I went home and said to my dad, I want to join the boxing gym. He says, right. And he took me down. And the night I went in, they were saying, right, time for sparring. And as a kid, it's going to go one of two ways. You either love it or you hate it. And I got punched square in the face and thought to myself, yep, this is a bit of me. And that was it. I never left. I loved it.
Were you good?
Yeah, I remember being a young kid and sparring and sort of getting away all the time. And I can remember people saying, you'll be Irish champion, you'll be Irish champion. I thought to myself, ah, that's mad. How could I be Irish champion? And I did, became Irish champion. Then it was, oh, you'll fight for Ireland, you'll fight for Ireland. And I did. Then it just snowballed like that.
Who were the fighters you looked up to as a kid?
Do you know, I always looked up to Clard Frampton. See, me and Clard, we boxed in the same club, and he was always a few years ahead of me. So everything that he was currently achieving, I was always, well, I want to do that. And because it was so close to home, I always said to myself, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And sort of, I always looked up to Clard because, like I said, he was always doing what I wanted to do.
Are you and Carl still mates today?
Yeah, I'm still chatting on again and stuff like that.
What did you make of his last fight against Herring?
I thought he was a bit heavy for the weight, so it was, I think, too much of a jump up, I personally thought. And I think if Carl had been in his prime, Carl would have won that fight.
He's also one of those fights where you think, well, maybe I did get out at the right time anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So how old were you when you had your first fight?
First boxing fight, I think I was 11 years old.
And was this out of the Belfast Cronk?
Yeah, Belfast Cronk. Tony Dunlap coached me.
Was Emmanuel Stewart ever over there?
Yeah, I met Emmanuel Stewart, come over, and I met him and Tommy Hearns. So I did, and it was a class. It was really good. And I always remember Emmanuel Stewart leaning over to me and saying to me, you're going to be my next world champion. I was like, it's class.
How old were you then when he said that?
I was 12, 13 maybe.
And then at some point you moved to Jerry Story's Holy Family Gym.
Yeah.
So how come that, why did that move come about?
I won 3 Irish titles with the Crunk. And I thought I hit a ceiling with them. I wasn't learning much anymore and I wasn't being challenged. And I knew this at such a young age. And I thought, well, I want to be pushed even more so. So Paddy Barnes was training at Holy Family Gym. And I always seen that Paddy was doing great. And I contacted Paddy and I says, would I be able to go down and train in the gym? He spoke to Jerry and that was it. I went down and started training there and that was then my new club.
What were your first impressions of Jerry Story?
I remember he was very old school and very disciplined. And that was sort of something that stuck with me. Jerry would teach the basics very, very well. Very old school mentality, which was working at the time.
And tell me about what he meant or what he means for Ireland on the greater scheme of things. Obviously, I've read Don McRae's book, In Sunshine and Shadow, where Jerry's sort of the cornerstone of the whole book. What does being a boxer from the Holy Family mean, and what does Jerry's story bring to the table away from boxing?
See, away from boxing, Jerry's very involved with the community. So when all the troubles were happening and there was Catholics and Protestants going mad, Catholics and Protestants would go into Jerry's gym. And Jerry made it where it doesn't matter what side of the wall you come from, when you're in this gym, we're friends and we get along together. And you could be throwing stones at each other in the street, and then you go into that gym and it was like everything just disappeared for a while. And then, but that was the effect that Jerry had outside of the gym. People sort of respected him on both sides of the wall.
So who else was training there at the time? Paddy?
Paddy Barnes was training there. Carl Frampton was doing a bit there, because Carl would go back and forth from the gym at Tigers Bay and then over to Jerry's as well.
Did you ever have Catholic-Protestant arguments with any other fighters?
No, never. Never. I think, and the reason why I didn't was because it was installed in me from Jerry that that's not the person you are. You don't be like that ever, regardless in the gym or out of the gym. Religion doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter if you're a Catholic or a Protestant. You treat people how they treat you. And that sort of having that mentality, or having someone of such a senior age telling you stuff like that as a kid, sort of has made me now today not sectarian at all.
You won all Ireland titles, you won Ulster titles and multi-nations tournaments. So people who prophesize good things for you, they soon started coming, didn't they?
Sorry, my phone said question again, sorry.
Sorry, I said you won all Ireland titles, you won Ulster titles and multi-nations tournaments. So those who predicted big things for you, they soon started to happen, didn't they?
Yeah, they happened really quick. Any competition that I went into, I was winning. And I was lucky enough that I won 7 Irish titles. So, lucky enough.
Have you kept the trophies from all those days?
Yeah, I've got them all. They're all in my roof space. I've got them all.
Are they?
Yeah.
Are you going to put them out on display at all?
I don't know. I've thought about it. I have my world medal out and my youth Olympic medal out. They're the only two I keep out from the amateur game.
Yeah. So moving on, you won silver at the 2010 World Youth Championships. You won 5 fights in 7 days before losing to the hometown guy. This was in Baku. You fought Salman Alizade.
Yeah.
What was that Baku tournament like? And reading what I've read, it sounded like it was a dubious decision at best.
Yeah, I definitely feel I won the fight, but in Azerbaijan, fighting someone from Azerbaijan, I just remember coming in the stadium and the Azerbaijan army were in the stadium, and the whole week there was no one there, and they were going for the finals. They were going absolutely crazy. And any time this guy threw a punch and it missed me, this army were going crazy. And I'm pretty sure I was convincing the judges to go, oh, give him a point.
So you think you how did it feel going through, what was it, I think 5 fights in 7 days and then losing, but getting silver? Were you content with the silver, or did you feel hard done by?
No, I almost hit him over the head with it. So I was fuming. I should have been world champion. I definitely should have been world champion. But I got my revenge with him.
Of course. Yeah, we'll go on to that. Who were some of the fighters, by the way, that were on your amateur teams? Who went on to become big news?
Joe Ward, Davey Oliver Joyce, Tommy McCarthy, Tyrone McCulloch, Paddy Barnes. That was sort of the ones that stuck out to me.
You were also quite close to Tyson Fury back then, weren't you?
Yeah, it was. Me and Tyson Fury, we boxed on a show in Philadelphia together. And it was the strangest thing because I was so small. I'm not joking. I must have been 5 foot at the time. And he was 6 foot eight or whatever he was. And me and him just clicked, and me and him just became good friends.
Have you got any funny Fury stories from back in the day? Was he just as mad then as he is now?
Yeah, he was. He was always joking about, messing about, and everywhere we would go, because in America everyone was so tall, he just used to pick me up and set me on his shoulders. And that's what he just used to do. Pick me up, set me on his shoulders. And I used to used to sit on his shoulders.
You won the first Olympic Youth Games in 2010. So the first ever. That was in Singapore. And you beat Alizade in the final. You beat him clearly as well this time, 13-6.
Yeah. That was the rematch that happened in the World Championships. And I always said, if I get him outside Azerbaijan, because he beat me twice, he robbed me twice, and they were both in Azerbaijan, and I always said, if I get him outside Azerbaijan, I'll absolutely destroy him, and rightly so. I got him outside Azerbaijan and beat him.
So your amateur career, am I right in saying 94 wins against 4 losses?
Yeah.
And so you dispute at least 2 or 3 of those losses then?
Yeah, definitely.
So is there one that you don't dispute?
No.
So you dispute all of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. Who were the other two to beat you? Do you know off the top of your head?
So, Michael Conlon.
Okay.
He beat me, and it was very, very close. It could have went either way.
Are you close to Michael?
Yeah. Michael joined, came with Adam a couple of years back, and we got on really well.
And then, so you turned pro in January 2012 with Ricky Hatton. What was going on between 2010 and 2012? Were you just fighting amateur shows? Because I can't see much in my research. Can't find what was going on.
So I, after the Youth Olympics, I decided to go pro. And we flew over to Manchester. And got talking to Ricky Hatton, and he decided that he was going to be my coach. So I'd left the amateur game then, and that was when all the trouble started with my brain, where I couldn't get a license. So it took nearly 2 years for me to be able to fight again.
So when you say you had trouble with the brain, so is this when you applied for a professional license and there was problems with your brain scan?
Yeah.
Did you get to the bottom of what the issue was?
Yeah, so basically, they're in one of the main arteries in my brain. There's a blockage. And on a normal brain scan, it shows this blockage. And the British Board of Control, they're so strict. If there's anything, they won't give you a license. But this is, I've had this from birth. And obviously, I didn't know about it. But what has happened has, because there's a blockage in the artery, my brain has created a path around the blockage. So the blood's coming to the blockage and just going around it, and it's continuing as normal. But to be able to prove that to the board took forever.
How hard was that period then? Because obviously you had these big dreams and aspirations, but you couldn't do anything.
It was brutal, because I was 21 years old and I was thinking, I need to be fighting here. I need to get going. And I had a doctor phone me and said, sorry, you're never going to box again. So when someone like a doctor rings you and tells you something like that, you're thinking, oh, this might be over. But there was always just something telling me, nah, it can't be. This is definitely not the way it's meant to go. So I kept going and kept going and kept going. With this problem that they said I had, my speech, it should have been slurred. My reaction should have been slow, and there was none of that. So I sort of always had it in my head, something just doesn't add up here. So kept pushing and had to go for an angiogram to find out what way the blood was flowing around my brain, and it took forever.
Now, in doing some of the homework, it said that, well, it didn't say that London 2012 was on your horizon. It said that you were a possible contender for Rio 2016. What was the deal with the Olympics?
I didn't want to go. I was done with the amateur game. I wanted to turn pro. I wanted to fight pro. I knew that that's where I can really progress and get good. And I knew that I needed all the learning I could possibly get. So hanging off for Rio just didn't do anything for me. I mean, what was it going to give me, a medal? What's a medal at the end of the day? Just absolutely nothing.
Some people have dined out on their medals for years afterwards. So, I mean, sometimes it's difficult, isn't it? I suppose it depends on how you get that medal, and also depends on how you follow up. But, I mean, I see what you're saying, though. You can't eat a medal. A medal doesn't necessarily put food on the table.
Yeah, I mean, you get a medal, and it's great. And it's one of the best achievements you can do is getting a medal at the Olympics. But at the end of the day, what is it? It's a medal that's going to hang on the mantelpiece. I know a lot of people have different views of it, but my view is it doesn't do anything for me. It's a medal.
Even after turning pro, and I think having a couple of fights, the brain scan thing re-emerged, didn't it?
No, it wasn't that it re-emerged. I went to have a fight. I think it was my second fight, my third fight it might have been. And I was in the change room getting ready. I was getting wrapped up by Ricky, and one of the doctors, the officials, came in and said, he hasn't got his medical. And we can't allow him to fight. And that was it. I was pulled off the show. And then I had to go back and do my medicals again. Got my license again, and that was it. Was going back at it.
Were you ever concerned that the brain injury or the brain scan or what was detected on the brain scan might actually cause an issue at some point?
No, because it's a strange feeling. I knew that, and I don't know why, there's nothing wrong with me. I am fine. I've been punched in the face numerous of times and nothing's happened. So to me, it was like, well, everyone else is wrong. I'm definitely right here. I'm okay. So I always knew that it'll be fine. It'll be fine because I didn't feel anything.
So you felt that the brain was fine, but there were times where you thought the dream was over before it even started.
Oh, yeah. I remember sitting in a house share. So I moved to England on my own when I was 19, and I rented a room in Manchester. And I was sitting there, no friends, no family over there, no one. And I got a phone call from a doctor. And the doctor says, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but you're not going to be able to box. It's not going to happen, and this is why. And he said these things. And after I hung up the phone, I just sat there, and I was like, what do I do now? I'm not allowed to box anymore. And I remember just sitting in this room, this dirty, dirty, stinking room, thinking, what am I going to do? I'm 19, I'm living in England on my own. This guy's just told me I'm not allowed to box anymore. And I sat for a while. And then I just thought to myself, no way. This is not the way it's meant to go. No way. I refuse that this is the way my life is meant to go. And that's when I decided I'm going to have to prove these people wrong somehow.
You had your first fight in May 2013 in Liverpool. How big a relief was it to finally get in there and get a win and get a fight under your belt?
It felt like right up to that moment, it was like, I just want this to happen, because once I have one pro fight, then that's it. The ball's run. I can't be stopped now. So once I get this one, then that's it. Like, no one can say anything. I'm a professional boxer and that's it. So I can remember stopping the guy. And the biggest relief was not that it won the fight, it was the fact that that's me, I'm a boxer now. Like, I'm 1-0, this is me.
Yeah, because I can imagine with all the obstacles you've had up to this point that, you know, it's one of those things you'll believe it when you see it. Like, when the bell rings, there's no going back. But until that bell rings, anything could happen with one disaster after another like you'd had.
Yeah. In boxing's so unpredictable. I mean, like, I had a guy come into my changing room once and say, just before a pro fight, sorry, that's you can't fight. Get changed and go home. So, like, with boxing, you know yourself, it's the most unpredictable sport in the world.
You wound up fighting in that May, in June, October, November to finish 4-0 in your debut year. But then you didn't fight for another year. Was this where you split with Ricky?
Yeah, I split with Ricky. and just pursued trying to get another coach. And it took a long time for that to get right.
So what was Ricky like as a coach? I mean, we met, didn't we, for the first time when I was up writing Ricky's book. I don't know if you remember.
I do. That
was when you were up there and you were a lonely dude up there. I know that you struggled up there. Why did you need to move on?
Rick's like, I don't know what way to put this. Rick really does have a heart of gold, and he is probably one of the nicest given people I've ever met. But things just weren't as professional as what I wanted them to be. So in this boxing, you have to give yourself the best chance that you can. And I just found that with Rick, it just wasn't as professional, very fine detailed to what I expected it to be. So I decided to jump ship and try to get another coach.
Did you try out other coaches, or did you find Adam straight away?
No, it took a long time. It took a long time just to get in the door with Adam. I always, the next coach for me was, well, we had two in mind. It was Dominic Ingle or Adam Booth. And we always wanted to go with Adam, but Adam was such a high profile man then, and I was essentially a nobody. And we tried to get in contact with him, and we just couldn't, until I thought to myself, he trains Andy Lee, and I'm friendly with Andy Lee. I'll see what Andy can do for me. And Andy spoke to him, and that sort of got the door open for me.
That was my next question, you know, was Andy involved? Did you do a trial period with Dominic Ingle?
No, I think it was meant to happen, but it just didn't for some reason. I can't remember.
Do I remember you being a bit homesick?
Oh yeah, I was really homesick. I hear that.
Did you not think about moving home and turning pro fighting out of Belfast?
No, because I knew my opportunities were going to be a lot better in England than they were back home. So that I have more of a chance of succeeding if I'm in England than what I am back home.
And so tell me about your first meeting with Adam.
So Andy Lee had said, yeah, you can come down, you can train. And we arranged a training session with Adam. And I can remember going in and warming up and stuff and hitting the pads. And I was on fire. I was performing well. And after he came out from his office and he handed me a blue t-shirt, a boxing blue t-shirt, I thought to myself, I'm in the door. And after the training session, I phoned my dad and I said, Dad, give me a t-shirt. He's definitely going to be my coach. So we went on a month trial just to see how we click, and rightly so, it all went well and he became a coach.
I remember Dave Allen talking about trying to adapt to a short period he had with Adam. He was talking about how he had soreness in places where he didn't think he could get soreness from where Adam gets you doing drills and moving in certain ways. Did you find that it was an unusual, that you were just moving differently to how you'd been moving before?
Yeah, I think it was with Adam, it was the simple things, like the real basics of boxing, that I was so taken back by. I thought I knew boxing. And when I started training with Adam, I quickly realized you don't know anything. And it was simple things like how to throw a perfect jab, which I'd never been taught to his standard before. And that was quality. I sort of, when Adam gets into the nitty and gritty of things, you realize why Adam Booth is and has achieved what he has done.
So how do you get a perfect jab? How much practice does that take, and what do you practice it on?
Well, it never stopped. The perfect jab never stopped, and Adam was never happy with it. So the perfect jab was always in play, always training for it.
So say you were going to do a session that focused on the jab. Would you hit the heavy bag 1,000 times with a jab? Would you just work in it? Would there be rounds in training, or would there be rounds on the mitts and in sparring where you could just fire the jab and only the jab? Was it that specific?
Adam didn't really like us throwing a jab on the bag, like focusing on perfect technique on the bag. It was always on pad work, that it would flow better. So yeah, it was pad work. Paddle work and shadow boxing. Slow shadow boxing.
You had two fights in 2014, but six in 2015. So you must have felt like you'd hit the lottery in the sense of that you're finally getting some activity 3 years after turning pro. That included a trip to fight at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn on a show topped by, well, co-featuring Andy against Kid Chocolate and Danny Garcia against Lamont Peterson. Did you enjoy being part of all that?
Oh, it's incredible. That was my first real taste of, yeah, this is what it's like on the big shows. Adam's focus was on Andy Lee. Obviously, he's fighting for a world title. Fighting for his world title. So it was amazing just to be in the background and watching how Adam dealt with Andy, what Adam would do, how Andy would deal with everything. I sort of sat back and just watched how it was all unfolding. So when it happened to me, I thought I had the experience of really what it was about, what was going on. So that was an incredible trip.
I've got to say, the way that you say that, it reminded me of Steve Farhood, who I recently interviewed for this podcast, who was the former editor of KO and Ring Magazine and now is an announcer on Showtime. And he was talking about cutting his teeth. And he was, he said, there's so much to be learned from when you're a young kid in boxing, shutting up and listening. And he's bang on, isn't he? Because when I go back to my early days in America in around about 2000, 2004, I probably didn't really meet many people, but I was everywhere. And all I would do is shut up and listen. And you just got to take it all in and you learn so much.
Yeah. It's so true what they say. The man who isn't talking, he's listening. So just watch out for the man being quiet. Definitely.
Yeah. Was America ever a dream for you? You know, we've obviously seen Carl fight Madison Square Garden. Obviously, Barry took on Vegas years ago. Did you want Madison Square Garden? Did you want the bright lights of Vegas? Or were you not fussed by that?
I wasn't fussed. My goal then was to fight for a world title. And didn't matter if it had been in the street or in the MGM. To me, when you're in that ring, you're in the ring, and it's only you. So it could have been anywhere.
You won the vacant British title against Jason Booth. What are your memories of that fight? You put him down in the first. Did you think it could be over quickly?
I put him down in the first, and I thought to myself, well, this is going exactly how I thought it would have went. And then his experience came out of the bag, and he started holding me, turning me, surviving. And I basically couldn't do anything with him. I was winning every round quite clear, but just his experience just took me back so much. He was able to hold me and control me in any way he wanted. So I couldn't get rid of him because he was just far, far too experienced for me, who was so young and just tenacious, wanted a fight. He'd seen that all day long.
So in many ways, it's what people would call a perfect learning fight.
Yeah, it really was a perfect learning fight. Yeah.
You had a couple of contests for the WBC international title. Then came Ryan Farag on the Bellew BJ Flores bill in Liverpool. What was that night like going into hostile territory?
I can remember standing, waiting to do my ring walk. And someone spat on me and it just whack hit me in the side. And they were just hurling abuse at me, and I was only about 10 foot away from them, 6 to 10 foot away from them, and they were just howling at me, and someone spat on me, and it was an experience to say the least.
that's pretty grim. So you were gloved up in that. How do you wipe off someone's spit with gloves?
Sort of bit of shoulder action. I was pretty. What can you do? You can't do anything. You're just about to get into the ring, and what can you do? Like, you just have to roll with it, I suppose.
By this point, you were with Matchroom. Was that a good fit for you?
Yeah, it really was. People have this mad hatred against Eddie Hearn for whatever reason. I don't know, everyone seems to hate him, but genuinely, he's one of the good ones in boxing. He really, really is. He did a lot for me. So he did.
In 2017, it happened and you won your first world title. You beat Lee Haskins at the Odyssey Arena in Belfast. What did not only winning the title mean to you, but what did winning it there mean to you?
So, like if I could fight anywhere, it would be Belfast, because you're in your hometown, you know everybody. That was, I guess my hairs are standing up my arms now. It'll always stay with me, that feeling was special, like, really was.
But you've obviously alluded to this earlier, you touched upon it earlier, that, you know, you reached the top of the mountain, but it wasn't the mountain that you necessarily thought that you were scaling. You know, you wanted to be on the top of the mountain over there. But that night, I mean, surely there was elation and jubilation, all the other things that you'd expect. You must have felt like you were walking on air.
No, not one bit. Not one bit. I can remember becoming world champion, and it was great. In that ring, there was like a moment where I was like, oh, I've done it. And then there was so much going on. And I remember getting back home, or back to the hotel room with Laura. And I sat down on the edge of the bed and I said to her, this isn't what I wanted. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And she was like, what? You're a world champion. This is all you never shut up about this. I was just in that moment, like something changed that was like, this is definitely wasn't what you were searching for. Like being world champion, it's when you're not a world champion, it's all you want. But when you are a world champion, you realize, for me, that there is more important things in life. And that was securing a life for my family.
It's interesting that you talk about this. And obviously, we've talked about your trials and tribulations, but even the night you won the title, it wasn't straightforward, was it? You won well on the scorecards, but it wasn't as straightforward as it made out, was it? And I suppose this really is what you mean by there was other stuff going on.
The what, sorry?
I suppose this is what you mean when you said there was other stuff going on the night. There was issues with the scorecards, wasn't there?
Yeah, one of the judges, we were pretty convinced that I won every round, clearly enough. But one of the judges had me down by like 11 rounds or something like that. And I can remember when they were calling out the scorecards, it's a split decision. I was like, fuck. I want to give it to the champion here. And they called out the scorecards, and I was just saying, please don't let them take it from me. And what had happened was one of the judges mistaken me for Lee Haskins.
Yeah, and after the fight, British Boxing Border Control General Secretary Robert Smith said, Clark San Martino won't be coming back. I don't know if he's come back, but yeah, he scored the fight for the wrong person, which is...
Yeah.
Bonkers for a world title fight. Just going into that fight, by the way, if we just rewind, Lee Haskins, a very awkward but very capable fighter. Were you concerned about the type of fight it was going to be? Were you concerned that you weren't going to be able to put on a show and all the rest of it?
No, I've never been concerned about putting on a show or anything like that. The main focus was to win. And if it had been a dog fight, it was a dog fight. If it had been a tricky standoff fight, that's what it would have been. We knew what way Haskins boxed, and we drilled exactly what I had to do, and it played exactly the way it did in the night.
In your next fight, which was only 4 months later, by the way, you added the WBA title when you defeated Zanet Zakianov at the new SSE. So what was the Odyssey, I think.
Yeah.
Was that the career high for you?
Yeah. I mean, unified the division, like I got the two belts in the division. It was a massive one for me, especially because Zakianov used to beat me up all the time. I used to spar him in Hatton's gym, and I remember him just used to beat me up. So finally being able to beat him was a sweet one.
Wow. So I was going to ask whether you guys had sparred. I seem to think, and I was going to ask this, was there an extra degree of satisfaction given he was with Ricky, or was it not like that?
No, wasn't like that at all. Not one bit.
Just, I wanted to touch upon your split with Ricky just a little bit more, if I can. You'd obviously mentioned about the homesickness in Manchester. You'd mentioned about living in a bedsit and all the rest of it. I'd actually seen this stuff about Josh Taylor when he was with the McGuigans, saying about he wasn't happy with where he was living and all the stuff. But should, even if you're a decorated amateur, should you guys be going into luxury quarters, or should you be put in, you know, rough bedsits to try and breed that hunger, to try and breed that champions mentality? Going back to the old Marvin Hagler silk pajamas thing.
Personally, when I moved to Manchester, I lived for the first maybe year. I lived in probably one of the worst places you could have lived, and it definitely gives me a hunger. Definitely, I think if you're waking up in your lovely place, I think you have to work to deserve that. You have to earn that right. You can't just be given that. I think that would definitely take the hunger away from a younger fella who has never had it before.
And now you have reached there. You can look back and with a degree of satisfaction, knowing that back in the day you did pay your dues.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely.
Because I'm definitely. Guessing back then you weren't waking up in silk pajamas.
At the stories I could tell you about the places where I lived at before becoming anything, you wouldn't believe it. You think it was land.
Go on, tell me about one place.
I came back from training once. I was renting this house here. I came back from training once and I walked into my room and the roof had collapsed in all on my clothes. So like a water pipe had bust all over my clothes and it just destroyed everything. It was like really dirty, manky water. And it destroyed everything. And I was that exhausted from training that I can remember just looking at my bed. My bed was fine. And I just went and got into bed and just thought, I'll fucking deal with that another time. So, but things like that, like living with ants and stuff, it's just disgusting.
After you were double champ and around that time, how close were you and Adam? Were you guys friends? And am I right in thinking that you lived with him during fight camps?
Yeah, during training camps, I used to live with Adam. Yeah, we got on really well. Adam sort of, he played like a father figure for me. And he helped me when definitely a lot of people wouldn't have. And Adam really did go above and beyond to try to make my life stable as possible for when I was up and coming.
I apologize if I'm wrong here, but do I remember your dad being on the scene a lot from when you were with Ricky and coming over and stuff?
Yeah, he was on the scene for a while and then he just disappeared. Broke away.
What do you mean disappeared? Have you guys fallen out?
Yeah, we fell out a while ago and then that was it, really.
Are you not in touch now?
No, I haven't spoke to him in years.
Oh, wow, because he was when I say on the scene, he was quite heavily involved, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He quite a lot.
He was, yeah. He was really heavily involved, and he was very shoulder to shoulder, so to speak. But without getting into too much detail, he didn't like my setup of what I was trying to do, and that was it. We sort of just went separate ways.
Did you agree to go your separate ways, or have you just there's just been a wall of silence?
It's a wall of silence, definitely.
Do you imagine making her amends?
No chance.
Wow, that's really shocked me. I'm sorry to hear that.
It's all right.
You defended the WBA title against Parejo on the Joshua Parker bill in Wales, and then came the World Boxing Super Series. How pumped were you for that tournament?
I was thinking to myself, I can definitely win this. I can definitely win this. I was good to go. I'd watched everybody and analysed everybody in that tournament, and I couldn't help but think to myself that if I turn up on the night and I bring my A game, I can win this. I can beat anyone in this tournament. And I sort of, that was the mindset that I had.
Cool. And just jog my memory. Who were the runners and riders?
You had Dinar, Anui, Juan Perez.
Oh, yeah. Perez, yeah.
You had Tete. You had the Russian guy. I think he was only 4-0 and he was in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've given me enough color there. So Inui, Danair, yeah. I mean, that's and Tete. Obviously, people were talking about all these different dream scenarios that came out of all the possible fights, and I don't think too many of them actually wound up happening for one reason or another. The final was one of the fights of the year, but you got to pick your opponent, didn't you?
Yeah. Got the pick, and I picked Dinar. I just thought Dinar is one of the best in the tournament, so why not fight the best?
The flip side for that, you know, if I'm being cynical, could say, well, Dinar he's one of the older guys, and he's also got to come down into two weights to fight you.
Yeah, of course.
So you for what you might say, you know, is a heroic pick on one hand, you'll always have detractors coming at you with the other hand, as you know in the sport.
Yeah, well, anything you do in the sport, you'll have people giving you the flip side of it. Yes, of course, he was a bit older and he had to come down the weight divisions, but Adam would never go into a fight relying on someone else's weaknesses. Never. And so we never thought, oh, he's the struggle to make the weight, or he might be a bit older. It was never like that. Adam would never allow you to be relying on someone's weaknesses.
Was he always your pick, or with hindsight, would you have picked someone else, or, you know, who else was in contention to be picked? Did you nearly think, sod it, let's have Inoue?
straight forward.
Why not make a statement, eh?
I wanted to fight Dinar. Dinar is someone I've looked up to as a kid. So to get the chance to share a ring with him was definitely a smart pick.
So talk me through the fight. I think it's safe to say you were sort of winning. You took a couple of the early rounds, but talk me through what happened.
Everything was going as planned, and I was feeling like it was just starting to settle into my rhythm. I could see his shots coming and missing, and I was thinking to myself, if I keep doing what I'm doing here, I'm going to win this fight. It was all going well. And then I can remember throwing a right hand and just having this almighty pain. I felt like someone had pulled my side out. And I went down. And when I was on the ground, I just thought to myself, well, if I get up, it might have just been a niggle. It might be away. And as I tried to stand up, it was like, it's hard to explain what kind of pain it was. Just someone's twisting a knife inside me. So I got up and tried to fight on, and I was in the corner and I was making a miss, but because my oblique had ripped in half, there was nothing protecting my hip. So when I was moving, it ripped the muscle off my hip bone as well. And I just remember trying to survive the round. And I got back into the corner and I was in a bad way. And Adam's like, look, I'm going to pull the fight. And I went, no. I can fight. And Adam, obviously his main job is to look after a fighter. So he made the right choice. There was no way that I could have went out there and done anything. My body simply wasn't working. So he did the right thing by calling it a day.
When you were in there with Danae, obviously he's got vaunted power. Did you either feel the power, or did you hear his shots winging by and think, geez, let's stay out of the way of those?
Yeah, he threw a left hook at me and it went past my face. I could see it coming and I sort of just pulled it out of the way and it just whizzed past my nose. I thought to myself, if it was any closer, I would have took my beard off. So yeah, you could definitely, you could feel it, definitely.
So on the scale of one, on the scale of 0 to 10, I don't know if you had to do this at the time, how much was the pain?
Oh, it was 10. Like,
You've never had anything like it in your life.
I'd never felt anything like that before. Nothing. I couldn't walk for, couldn't move for a month, really. After, I was in a bad way.
So when was it diagnosed that you'd torn your oblique? Which is that what it was? It was a torn oblique, and then was there further injury to the hip or what?
Yeah, the muscle come off. The muscle come off my hip, and I ripped the oblique in half.
And how long does that take to repair?
They said they were going to do surgery on it, but for whatever reason, there was a 50-50 of something else happening. So we decided to just let it repair itself. So it took forever to try to get me moving again.
What did you have to do to get better? Just rest?
It was rest, yeah. Rest and physio.
What sort of stuff were they doing on physio? Were they using like machines to try and get the muscle going and that?
Using the machines to try to knit the muscle back together properly and just get me doing just general physio stuff.
Was it? I'm right in thinking you had some bad injuries before, hadn't you? Your back and stuff.
Yeah, I slipped a disc in my lower back in 2008. That might have been.
But none of this was linked to anything that's happened before.
No. The doctor had said to me, I said, why has this happened? And they said, freak injury. They said they usually see accidents like this in car crashes when someone's thrown about on the inside of a car.
Bloody hell, that's mental.
Yeah.
That's mental. During that period of recovery and rehabilitation, are you thinking that this is a career-threatening injury and this could be it?
I never thought like that. It was always when I used to box. It was always any bad thing used to come into my mind. I would always say no, and I would just block it out, and that was it. I never gave it time to think. Oh, it might be over here.
What did the doctors say? Were they saying, you know, in terms of that injury that you'd suffered, were they saying that this could be the end of the line?
Yeah, it could be.
What was the feedback you were being given?
It could have been the end of the line, but I was always, I've heard that before.
Did you know for a fact, like there and then, that you were out of the WBSS? You knew that was going to come and go without you now?
Yeah, that was me done. I knew that.
Did you think you'd fight Danair again?
Yeah, I mean, there was a market there for it, definitely. And I thought maybe later down the line, me and him could do it again. But
Danair's a nice guy who's obviously very respected. And, you know, I've known him for years and years. Initially, he seemed a little bit sceptical about the injury. Do you agree?
Yeah, he was obviously a bit sceptical. I haven't watched any interviews or anything like that about it, but I'd say so. Maybe he thought it could have happened in training camp before or whatever it might have been, but it was a freak accident on the night.
I'm glad you mentioned that you hadn't watched any interviews back, because Adam tells me you've never watched one of your fights back.
No.
You've never seen one of your fights? Not one of them?
No. I've seen highlights, but I've never watched the fight. I'm too critical of myself. If I watch a fight, I beat myself up and I eat myself. If I remember watching a bit of one of my fights and I just thought to myself, you are shit. And I would just do my own head in about it. So as I said, I'm never going to watch myself. And even though I'm retired, I still haven't watched myself.
Wow. If you were to watch one fight back, what would you watch?
The Zakianov fight.
Okay.
It was a bit of a war, from what I remember, so probably a tasty one to watch.
Wow, I find that fascinating, you know, partly because of the ego thing and partly because, you know, for the spell when you missed boxing, that you wouldn't try and sort of live vicariously back through the tapes and stuff.
Yeah, never. Just never. I would never watch my opponents either. I would tell Adam, what's he like?
Let me ask you this, if you said, you know, you struggled in retirement, and I know we've still got one more fight to cover, but you struggled in retirement. But obviously, when you got to the world title, it wasn't all you thought it was going to be. Why did you struggle? What made you struggle? Why miss something that wasn't all it was cracked up to be? What did you?
Because it was my life. I didn't have another life. I was Ryan Burnett, the boxer. I didn't know what it was like to go for a week without training. I didn't know. My whole life was different on a massive, massive scale. It was completely different. So changing. I wouldn't drink that much. But when I was retired, I could have done whatever I wanted. So I was drinking. I was eating bad food constantly because I was retired. I could. There was no one there to tell me no, so to speak.
So, Ryan Burnett, the boxer, so part of it was an identity thing that, you know, it was always going to be, you know, everyone's talking about the last fight and the next fight. And now they're like, I haven't really got anything to say because you're no longer the boxer.
Yeah, in a way, it's just a massive shift in life. So it was now thinking to myself, how am I going to get money? What am I going to do? Didn't go to school. Didn't do school properly at all. I have no qualifications. I have nothing to lean back on. Absolutely nothing. What do I do?
What about the drug, the thrill of fight night, you know, the nerves, the pre-fight nerves and all that? Did you miss that high? Because obviously that's what we hear fighters have chased in retirement, because they can't get that high.
Yeah, there's nothing going to give you that. Nothing's going to give you that. They say the only thing that comes close to that is to do drugs. And even at my worst, I was always lucky enough to say, no, I'm not going to do drugs. That's just not going to be that person. So, yeah, you definitely crave that. I crave that laser focus on something. That's something I really miss. I miss being standing in the ring with someone and just being laser focused on what I'm doing. It's not necessarily the massive night and the accolade that comes with it. It was the being that moment of just utter focus. Nothing else is existing in the world but just what you're focusing on. That's something that I don't know what would give you that.
So you mentioned there, you said there's nothing that will give you that. How hard is it to accept that you've had those highs and you can't replace them with anything?
Well, you can't replace it with anything. So what I do is I look back and I think about what I'm grateful for, and that quickly shuts off everything. I'm madly grateful for every single thing in my life, right down to the very, very small stuff, and I don't let myself ever forget it. And when you're feeling shit and you're feeling down and you're missing this of a boxer and this and the lifestyle, and I always just revert back to, well, do you know what? You end up with everything you wanted. You have a home, you have this, you have that, and then this thing that's so good doesn't really matter anymore.
You didn't fight for 6 months. You gave it one last shot and you beat Gomera at the Ulster Hall, but something told you that was it. Why did you walk away? Why was that time? Was training camp physically difficult?
Training camp was difficult. Couldn't spar. When I was in the ring, I couldn't move like I normally did. It just didn't go back to the way things were. And I knew then that when you can't spar, there's no point. Like, I couldn't spar. I'm just so much pain. I just couldn't spar. And I sort of said to myself, well, I owe it to myself to grit my teeth and get through this. So I was definitely having that fight. If I only had one arm, I was definitely having that fight. There was no way that I was going out of my career with a loss. I just really didn't want that to be the end of my story. So even through the training camp, it was like, I'm definitely fighting regardless of anything. If I'm no sparring or anything, I'm still going to fight.
You couldn't spar in case someone hit you in the injured area?
couldn't spar because my body was that bad in pain. I couldn't train right. Because you're pushing yourself to the absolute max, and everyone knew when I trained, I didn't go 90% or 95%. It was 100% every single time. So much so, Adam used to go crazy at me. He used to tell me to stop. And having that mentality, it kept me injured.
And during that last fight, were you in pain during the last fight?
Yeah, I was. Later on, not so much during the fight because your adrenaline's going and everything's flowing, but later on that night and then the next few days after, it just wasn't right.
Are you thinking during that fight, this is it? Or are you thinking before that fight, this is actually going to be it?
I thought that after the fight, I could go and speak to someone and get looked at and then everything will be fine again. But I avoided everything. I was like, no, I'm fine. But when all the smoke went away, it was, well, I'm not fine.
So basically you put a plaster on it and you just covered it up and thought, I'll put it off. And then when you had to sit down and address it, you were like, yeah, the time's come and gone now.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, your health's your wealth, and there's no point. I was only 27 when I retired, so I was young enough to think to myself, I can do something else with my life. But if I really fuck myself up here, I'm gonna ruin my life.
You speak obviously with this contentment and gratitude for what you've achieved, and obviously rightly so. Do you think you're a little bit more gracious and happy with what you've achieved because even before you nearly turned pro, it was all taken away? So really anything on top of that was going to be a plus. The fact that you've achieved what you've achieved in spite of everything, do you think that's allowed you to be more content? Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I always had a grateful attitude towards anything that was happening simply because it had been taken away from me before. So nothing in my life was took for granted, I suppose.
And you've got big now.
I put on a little bit of weight. I wouldn't make bantam weight anymore.
what weight would you be?
What now? I'm just over 11 stone. So I used to fight at 8 stone 6.
So what sort of stuff are you doing? Are you literally just doing weight training? Are you doing body splits? How's it working?
Just weight training. I can't remember the last time I ran the length of myself.
Do you enjoy it?
Do you know what? It's not necessarily enjoy it. It keeps me sane, I suppose, because my whole life I've trained. And when I retired, I didn't train for a while and I was going crazy. And then I start training. And it was like weight training's, it's simple. There's nothing to it, but it keeps me turning up the gym, do a bit of training. I hold myself accountable for it, and it sort of keeps me flowing correctly more than anything.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot to be said with endorphins, mental health, and that kind of stuff that can't be sniffed at for sure. And in terms of self-worth, I'm sure you feel a lot better about how you look now as opposed to how you look when you weren't training as well. And it all sort of, you know, even if you're not a particularly vain person, it all has an effect in one way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I try to keep myself as right as possible.
So. Adam said this, by the way, when I said, oh, what should I ask Ryan about? He said hospital button.
So after the, everyone knows me for my just insane drive to train as hard as I can. And just before the Zach Yanov fight, we were doing hill sprints. And I was getting to the top of the hill in a minute, and that was my best times. And after Zach Yanov fight, I went home and didn't do much and put on weight and got really unfit, as most boxers do. And then I went back in the training camp, I think like 2.5 months later. And one of our first sessions was hill sprints. And I said to myself, I'm going to do these hill sprints as good as I did at the end of my training camp. Now, bear in mind, I've merely jogged a few times. And rightly so, on my first hill sprint, I did it in like a minute, but it wiped me out. And then my next one, I did it in a minute. And I think I did 10 sprints, all right at like peak physique level of fitness, but obviously I wasn't fit. So I start after the training, I was vomiting, but I then start cramping. I couldn't speak. It was that bad. I was in a really bad way where Adam threw me into the car and thought, I'm going to have to go to the hospital here. So now I got the nickname Hospital Button because I was just, and Adam told me, don't stop it. And I said, no, I can keep going. This is after I was sick. And then I just end up really mashing myself up.
So how old are you now?
28.
And so is this life now? You've got your house and you've got your gym, which should be back open to the public with COVID restrictions when they're eased on April 30th. Is this it for you now?
Yeah, this is my life now. And where my life is at right now, I'm very content. I look back at my life and like what I've achieved and where I'm at, and pulling myself out of that mess that I was in when I retired and getting to myself to having a gym in the town centre. And I got married, I have a lovely wife, like I have my own home, I've got a wee dog. Like, I mean, to me, this is as good as it gets. Definitely.
Is it, you know, obviously Andy's gone on and is becoming a top trainer with some high profile clients. Is that something that you will plan to look at down the line?
Maybe. I've had a few professional boxers come to me and ask me, will I be their coach? Simply because, like, I'm only teaching them what Adam taught me. And professional boxers are coming to me and they're telling me, this is amazing. This is quality stuff. Will you be my coach? And every time I say no, because I'm focusing on getting my own business, this going. And when you're a coach, it's hard to make any sort of living as a beginner coach. So I'm focusing on getting this place perfect. And then you never know.
If you could do your career over again, would you change anything?
No, nothing. I think throughout my career, I made the right decisions with everything. Everything was done correctly. So there's nothing I regret in my career at all.
Do you have a bucket list now? Or are you too things to do for a bucket list? Yeah, yeah.
I don't necessarily have a bucket list, no. I don't know. I'm happy. I'm really happy with where my life is and what I'm doing. And I don't have a bucket list, no. Well, I always wanted a performance car. And okay. I got the performance car. So I'm happy with that. I bought myself the E43 Mercedes.
Do you still have
it? So I'm happy with that.
You still have it now?
Yeah, still got it.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, right.
Yeah, still got it.
I really appreciate your time, mate. It's been great to have a catch up. I'll try and dig out that old photo of me, you, and Ricky from his house in, it's got to be 2012, I guess.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah,
long time.
You're a bit heavier now. Mind you, I think me and Ricky both probably are as well. But no, it's been good. And I'm glad you're out the other side as well. And like, I still can't get my head around that we've been chatting all that time. And it's such a like detailed story. And you're still only 28. Like, you've covered a lot of ground in a short space of time.
Yeah, a lot's been happening. And to be honest, it's only going to get better for me as well. Like I'm doing big things, so I am with my life, and I'm going at life with the same attitude that I went at my boxing career with.
By the way, just one last thing, that World Boxing Super Series final, Inoue and Dinair was a fight of the year. Were you rooting for one or the other, and did you watch it live?
Say it again. Sorry, you broke up.
Sorry, the Inouye Dinair final of the WBSS. It was a fight of the year contender. Did you watch it live, and were you pulling for one fighter over the other?
I watched it, yeah. I wasn't pulling for any fighter. I just thought it was just a really great, enjoyable fight. I was rooting for both guys. I mean, it was a class fight. I enjoyed it.
Was it one of those where you think, oh, I wish that was me, or one of those where you think, thank God that wasn't me?
No, I was thinking that should be me. That guy should be in there doing that. Yeah.
And also, in fact, let me ask you this, because we talked about it a little bit off air at the start there. You still have the Harry Potter scar, don't you? Which is great. It's made you a meme for life.
Yeah, you can sort of see it there. It's never gone away.
Haskins, right?
Yeah, from Haskins, headbutt.
And how bad was that cut, and how many stitches did it take?
So I was talking to Jumbo, my cut man. And he said, it's the worst cut he's seen in 20 years. He said, when it happened, he put his thumbs on the cut and he opened the cut up and he seen my bone and he closed the cut and he leant over the atom and he said, this fight's going to get stopped in the next couple of rounds. So on the next round, Adam said to me, you have to win this round. I was like, right, okay. And lucky enough, and still this day, he says he doesn't know how he was able to stop it because it was such a bad cut. Then a couple of, I think it was about a week after, I went in and had plastic surgery done on it to heal it properly.
And you've shared your fair share of memes about it, haven't you? You don't mind?
No, I don't mind. People call me Harry Potter. Still to this day, a couple of mates call me Harry. Bit of crack.
Brilliant. All right, Ryan. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been great to catch up. And
nice
hopefully
one.
When you're over next, seeing Adam, we'll be able to sit down, have a chat, and maybe go out for some food.
Definitely. Sounds good.
Brilliant. Cheers, Ryan. Nice thank one. You so much, mate.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye.
It was great to have a chat with Ryan. It's been, well, I was going to say it's been a few years, but it actually wasn't that long. I think I spoke to him before, or maybe even after his last fight, when he was last over at Adam Booth's house. That sort of seems, that sounds familiar, and I think he was undecided whether he was going to be able to fight again. But thank you very much for joining us this week. A reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Already up on Patreon, episodes with Curtis Woodhouse, Philadelphia fight scribe Bernard Fernandez, and hopefully Kelly Pavlik by the end of the week. Zoom chats, you can buy copies of Damage up there and so forth. Loads going on at patreon.com/TrisDixon. And we'll be back next week.